The great pitfall of observation and analysis is assumption. Guard against it. The very rigor of thought lends strength to the temptation. Pride and consciousness of the knowing application of the science of warfare opens the mind to the hubris of infallibility. Assumptions result, and mistakes inevitably follow. The shield against such potentially fatal battlefield errors is adaptability. This is not simply, or even principally, the physical resilience that permits survival in adverse, shifting conditions. It is the ability to recognize that a given theoretical is exactly that, theoretical. Contrary facts must be respected, and the theory must be altered, or even abandoned, as indicated by reality, not by desire. The practical and war are both fluid and evolving. The advantage of the practical is that it is also conscious. Guilleman, Prolegomena to Tactics, 10.4.3. Chapter 4. The Plain. Strong point. Everywhere. The vehicle was a monstrous creation of chance. Anything the orcs managed to construct that was more complex than their axes and cleavers seemed to Guilleman to be the result more of happenstance than will. The question of how they managed to construct even a single void-worthy craft was still a mystery, one that had consumed the thoughts of more than one remembrancer. Even at first glance, Guilleman could easily imagine how this creation had come to pass. It looked like two separate vehicles had collided in the late stages of their construction. Its core was bulbous, as if still swelling from the force of the impact. Plates overlapped and folded against each other. The thing had too many wheels. Its shape was a sprawling nightmare. Its axles were bent. Some of the wheels were turned, at odds with the direction of the majority. Limbs projected from the fused chassis. They carried chains, wrecking balls, and 6-foot blades. Larger projectile guns than the ones carried by the foot soldiers were mounted on a multitude of skewed turrets. The thing wasn't a tank. It wasn't a transport. The orcs had been building two of their attack trucks, and the collision had, instead of destroying both, created a thing that still functioned. The orcs had built upon their chance machine, adding more and more guns and assault arms, slapping armor plate atop of armor plate. Now it bristled with death and the feral pride of the brutes. It appeared, and all the orcs within sight of the creation shouted in joyous ferocity. It was a mad thing, and its mere existence was their promise of ecstatic battle. It must die, Guilleman thought. It was an engine of orc morale. It had to be removed from the field. The vehicle was 200 yards northeast of his position. It would pass by him unless he caught up to it. The Land Raider Osiris closed with it, las cannons and heavy bolters pounding the front armor. Turrets exploded. Flames raced over the hull of the vehicle. It kept going. Guilleman counted at least 6 turrets still active. Their fire burst against the armor of Osiris. The two vehicles rumbled past each other. The orc machine's huge wrecking ball slammed into the flank of the Land Raider. The tank's composite held. But one of the huge masses hit the port sponson. It crushed the barrels of the las cannons as they fired. The guns exploded, damaging the armor in a way the orc vehicle could never have managed with its own weaponry. Energy blasted back into the Land Raider, triggering reserves of energy cells. The flash of the guns became a blinding, uncontrolled discharge. The port flank of Osiris blew out. The wreckage slammed into the orc machine, collapsing that side of its hull. The vehicle barreled on. It was excess given metallic form. It should never have worked at all, and because it did, it was unstoppable. Behind it came more orc vehicles, belching clouds of black smoke, streams of flame bursting from exhaust pipes and from between the seams of the poorly welded iron plates. The initial bombardment had destroyed many of the machines the orcs were capable of fielding. Some had survived, though, and they had gathered behind the largest. They converged on the wounded Osiris. Their solid shells slammed into it. Most bounced off the forward armor, but some found the huge rent in the port flank. The Land Raider was still moving, sluggishly, and fired only from the starboard side. Guilleman pounded over the ground towards Osiris. He ran alone, leaving the Invictari behind to continue cutting the path forwards through the horde. The risk was a strategic one. Theoretical, the greatest blow to orc morale will be a single warrior destroying their great weapon. Practical, I must be that warrior. He fired as he ran, blasting the way clear through the brutes. The orcs came at him with all their muscular savagery. Some of the beasts were almost twice his height. He did not let them slow him. He blew them apart with the shells of the Arbitrator. Incandor slashed throats and cut torsos wide open. He was a blade. His route took him through the bodies of his foe, reaping a tidal surge of blood. He was less than 50 feet from the stricken Land Raider. The orc machines had it surrounded. There were dozens of the vehicles. They were beyond crude. They were all accidents of design, products of savage enthusiasm that functioned despite themselves, explosive agglomerations of aggression and industry. They had isolated Osiris from the other Ultramarines' tanks. A pair of Land Raiders was blowing up the outlier orc machines, trying to force their way back in to aid Osiris. The others had no choice but to continue the advance. Gilliman had ordered there be no gap in the exterminating wall of heavy armor. The march must not stop. The orcs were disorder and riot. They would be driven back and purged from Thoas by discipline and coherent strategy. There were costs to order. Osiris might be one, but Gilliman had the freedom of movement. Where he moved in the field, he created the means of the advance. 30 feet. Orcs were jumping off the crowded roofs and sides of their vehicles and rushing into the gap in the Land Raider. They were mowed down by the fire of their own turrets and by the resistance of the Ultramarines in the tank. But there were always more. 15 feet. Osiris exploded. The fireball was sudden, a gigantic blast of killing light. Gilliman ran into the shockwave. Heat and force tried to scorch the flesh from his skull. Slabs of twisted armor wheeled end over end past him. Gilliman kept moving, straight into the fire, straight into the furnace. There was a moment when the world disappeared. He moved through a cauldron of deafening white pain. He pushed through it, carried by momentum and anger, and most of all, by necessity. On the other side was the blackened, roaring hulk of the orc machine. It was charging forwards again, multiple engines screaming with eagerness for more prey. Gilliman leapt. The arc of his jump carried him to the roof of the machine. It was a forest of pipes and turrets and spikes. He came down through a hail of shells. Flame and smoke billowed around him. The orcs, riding the vehicle, saw him coming. That did them no good. No preparation could help them. He landed with a blow that resonated through the entire hull. An orc died beneath his boots, its back crushed to pulp. The plating on the roof cracked and bent inward. The vehicle shuddered. Its advance hesitated. Gilliman made his way towards the rear, where the hull bulged and a forest of pipes spewed flame into the night. Greenskins clambered over the roof after him. He blasted them with the Arbitrator. The impact of the shells sent their bodies flying from the vehicle. He sheathed Incandor and wrapped his gauntlet around the nearest pipe. He squeezed. He wasn't wearing the Hand of Dominion, but he didn't need the power gauntlet. His own strength was more than enough. He constricted one pipe after another, forcing the heat flow back inside the engine. By the time he reached the back of the vehicle, the roof was trembling from the pressure. A loose exhaust pipe shot off like a missile. A jet of flame screamed upwards in its wake. Gilliman fired downwards. The combi bolter's shells hit the armor like a focused artillery strike. They punched through the metal and into the furnace of the engine. Gilliman kept firing. Orcs howled and clawed over each other in an effort to reach him and pull him down. Without shifting his focus, he grabbed Incandor from its mag-locked belt sheath. In the corner of his eye, he saw the shapes come for him, and he ripped them open. He was immobile, absolute as a mountain. The orc machine lurched forwards. It veered left and right, as if it might shake him off. He kept shooting into the engine, pummeling the interior with a directed stream of explosions. The orcs shrieked with frustration. Bullets careened off his armor. Blows landed. They meant nothing. He was unmoved. He was the judgment of reason, and he brought destruction to the unthinking war of the beasts. Gilliman felt the engines go critical. The hull tremors became violent and erratic, a heart in fibrillation. He jumped again, off the rear of the vehicle. He landed in the midst of more orcs. He was killing again as the machine rumbled and judded away from him. The clanking of its mechanism turned into the screech of tearing metal. The greenskins aboard ignored him now. They wailed as they fought to preserve the giant engine. Their efforts were futile. They did not understand how they had made their wonder. They knew even less how to preserve it. The machine exploded. Its death was even more violent than that of Osiris. It was as if all the brute energy of the species had been contained within the hull, and now it was unleashed in a single gigantic blast. The explosion formed a crater. Fire, earth, wind, and metal slammed into Gilliman. It flattened the orcs around him. It burned them. A chunk of shrapnel larger than a man sailed past him and cut a greenskin in half. Gilliman rooted himself. He turned his face from the explosion, but stood fast in the holocaust. Before the light faded, he heard another deep-throated explosion, and then another. The destruction of the vehicle was so huge it had reached the machines that had followed it so closely. They died for clinging to the irrational logic of survivors. They had clustered with the perceived victor, and now they perished. The firestorm spread. It gathered strength. Gilliman had avenged the killing of Osiris and its crew, but that was not enough. This instant was another moment to seize. All plans must adapt to contingent realities, or they are not plans. They are dreams. "All units, open fire!" he voxed to the other chapters. The battle was only a few minutes old, and the leading phalanx had still not fully plunged into the green tide. But this moment must be amplified. "Choose your enemies and destroy them. Artillery, we have more vehicular concentration. Target my coordinates. I want a massive bombardment now!" he shouted from deep within the firestorm. He could barely hear his own voice and the blank thunder of the flames, but he heard the new thunder when it came. He heard the shrieking of the shells, and he heard the shattering percussion of the shells landing. He strode through the devastation, killing the few orcs that managed to withstand the gunship cluster bombs and the Earthshaker ordnance. He moved through the blasts, listening for the roar of Thunderhawk engines and the whistle of descending shells, his hearing so fine he knew where the explosives would fall. He moved back and forth across the fiery plain, wrapped in the storm he had summoned. He emerged from the destruction. He left behind a new graveyard of orc vehicles. Ahead, the companies of the first chapter kept faith with the strategy and continued to plow a 1,000-yard-wide furrow through the orcs. Gilliman stormed forwards, Incandor held high. He passed through one company after another, joining his sons in the purging slaughter, and when they saw him, they shouted to him, and tore into the enemy with redoubled fury. Onwards, from company to company, until he was leading again, marching ahead of the line of tanks, scything the orcs with gladius and shell. Always advancing, this was the coherence of a battle with no ground yet to hold. Always towards the east, towards the mountains, towards the ruins, bringing the new glory of humanity to reclaim the old. The orcs were still fighting to reach the phalanx of the first chapter when the rest of the legion reached them. The line of the advance went from 1,000 yards wide to 10 times that. The orcs covered an even greater area, but they had taken Gilliman's bait. They were concentrated but focused on the wrong target. The main attack of the Ultramarines swept over them like a volcanic blast. Cirrus ran with his command squad between and just ahead of the Land Raiders, leading the 223rd's destruction of the orcs. He thought of Hyrax on the Kavaska. He wished for his old friend's presence. The opening moments of the campaign were deeply satisfying. The extermination of the enemy would be complete, even without the destroyer's weapons. The final end of this orc empire was preordained, and Hyrax deserved his share of the glory. An hour later, Cirrus was wishing for Hyrax's arsenal. The orcs shook off the impact of the initial shock. They were still dying, and the Ultramarines were still advancing through them. But the orcs were not fighting a defensive war. They didn't care about positions or held territory. All that mattered to them was the battle itself. They hurled themselves against the 13th Legion formations, but they also pulled back and circled around for a new angle of attack. There were so many of them, they attacked and retreated simultaneously. The contradictory movements were just eddies and currents in the green sea. Cirrus took apart a hulking chieftain with his lightning claws, then jumped on top of his command rhino Ecnomos for a better vantage of the battlefield. He looked back. He saw the orcs flooding around the rear of his company, opening up another front there. The advance suddenly meant nothing. Wherever he looked, there were greenskins beyond counting. The artillery barrage and the actions of the first chapter had destroyed virtually all of what passed for orc heavy armor, but the enemy's numbers had not been affected at all. Cursing, he turned around, surveying the battlefield. The 22nd chapter was operating at the northernmost edge of the Ultramarines' front. To the north, there was nothing but orcs, and also to the west, as if the Legion had never passed through. To the east, with orcs now visibly pouring down their slopes, the mountains were closer, along with the endless twilight. Above, the sky was already lighter, the stars more dim. To the south, the upheaval of war, the companies of 12 chapters turning the plain into a vista of smoke and fire and blood. There, Cirrus saw the illusion of progress. The orcs hit the forward edge of the companies, and the Primarch's great engine of war ground them to mulch. No orc attacking from the east was alive by the time the last battle brothers marched over the point of initial contact. It was all illusion, Cirrus thought. The orcs had an inexhaustible supply of warriors. The mob descended mountainsides along a line at least 10 miles long. The entire span of the chapters was no more than the central portion of the greenskin wave. Tens of thousands of orcs could not enter the war from the front, and so they looped around. The battles at the rear of the companies were already ferocious, and they were slowing down the pace of the advance as a whole. They've surrounded us, Cirrus thought. They'll try to drown us. He refused to accept the possibility of defeat. Instead, he looked for the means to prevent it. He looked north again. The land sloped away gradually in that direction. His gaze stopped on a deep shadow. It was much darker than the others cast over the plain by the mountains. It was long and jagged, its edges sharply defined. And the orcs were going around it. Cirrus blinked through levels of magnification of his helmet's photo lenses. The shadow was a chasm in the plain, a narrow canyon, perhaps 500 yards across at its widest. Its nearest point was less than a mile away. There were ways of ensuring what fell into those depths never emerged. He opened the rhino's hatch and dropped inside. Techmarine Nicandrus looked up from the banks of command screens and Auspex arrays. "I want a topographical scan," Cirrus told him. "North, approximately 2,000 yards from our position." He stood over Nicandrus and watched the image appear, layer by layer, on the picked screen. The gorge was a deep one. The sides were close to the vertical.
"A unique feature in this area," Nicandrus said.
"One to be exploited," said Cirrus.
He opened a vox channel to Iasis.
"Chapter Master," he said, "we have an opportunity. I propose to take the 223rd north of our current position to force the orcs into a canyon."
The correct maneuver could doom thousands of the greenskins, and the gorge was a real barrier to their movements.
"Negative," said Iasis. "Maintain position and vector of advance."
The answer came back so quickly, Cirrus wondered whether Iasis had understood him. He tried again.
"Theoretical. Any strategy whose result is the faster extermination of the enemy must be explored. Practical. A drive to the canyon would accomplish just that. We would lure the orcs to us while forcing them back over the cliffs."
"I am aware of the potential in what you propose," Iasis replied. "My answer is the same. Request denied."
Cirrus spoke through gritted teeth.
"Dogmatic adherence to initial strategies is the surest warranty of defeat," he said, quoting the Prolegomena.
"My refusal is not the product of rigidity, Captain. It is the result of analysis. Practical. Your maneuver would open up a gap in our lines. Theoretical. The opportunity you would provide the orcs is of more potential value to them than any possible benefit to us. You have your orders."
Iasis cut the channel. Cirrus clenched his fists. Nicandrus kept his attention carefully focused on the screens.
"Alert me of any other such geological features," Cirrus said, keeping what face he could.
"As you wish, Captain," Nicandrus answered.
Cirrus climbed back out of the hatch. With a snarl of anger, he jumped from Ecnomus at a charging orc. The brute wore thick plates of crude armor. It carried an axe whose blade was half the size of Cirrus. He ducked under the swing and stabbed upwards with his lightning claws. The blade sliced through the armor as easily as the flesh. Cirrus brought them all the way up through the green skin's jaw and out the top of its skull. Cirrus withdrew the claws and the orc fell. Behind it came more, infinitely more, Cirrus thought.
"Hyrax, you should be here," he thought, "and you should be leading Nemesis."
Where the plain ended, the ground rose steeply. When the first chapter reached it, the flood of orcs coming from this sector of the Cordillera had dwindled. Gilliman could see large steady flows still heading to the battle to the north and south. The spearhead had taken its toll, though. Here, at least, the orcs could no longer attempt to sweep away the ultramarines in a wave of brute force. There was a way up the slope for the tanks. The orbital scans of the mountains had revealed the telltale switchback patterns of roads at regular intervals leading up from the plain. Now he could see the state of those roads. They were badly pitted and cracked. Rockfalls had caused further damage. Gilliman moved the Vindicators to the lead, and as the column made its way up, the tank's siege blades saw heavy use. The blades and cannons were needed to clear rubble to such a degree, the climb was tantamount to a siege. From midway down the column, Gage voxed, "How long have the orcs been on Thoas? They seem to have been very busy."
"No more than a century or two," Gilliman said.
The figure was approximate, based on incomplete records pieced together from the other reclaimed worlds. There was enough consensus in the fragments to gather some sense of the system's histories during the Age of Strife.
"This damage is not all the doing of orcs," he said.
He doubted any significant amount had been caused by the Greenskins. He saw the scorch marks and scrapes caused by the passage of the Xenos army. They were clearly recent. The collapses and piles of debris were older. He saw the workings of erosion. The road had not been maintained for a long time. He frowned. This was not what he had expected to find. The final switchback led to a wide approach to the main gates of the ruins. The advancing legion had forced the remaining orcs back. They rallied now before huge doors. The entrance to the ruins was 100 feet high and 60 wide. The doors had a dark sheen. Though they were blackened, they showed none of the wear of the road. Gilliman suspected they were an alloy of adamantium and iron. They were engraved with huge runes in a language Gilliman did not know. The doorway was built into the wall of a structure as monumental as its entrance. The decaying pyramid emerged from the mountainside as if it were being extruded by the rock. Seen closer, the stone of its construction, though it had come from the mountains, had been machined to the point of being unrecognizable. The stone was smooth, deep black, and formed into gigantic slabs. The structure rose to a position just below the mountain peaks. It was angular, suggestive of being a half-buried octagon. The walls of each terraced level leaned outwards. Their angle, combined with the vertical thrust of the pyramid, made the ruin seem to loom over the two armies, perpetually toppling, yet unyielding. At regular intervals along the face of the mountain chain were more pyramids, all half-emerging from the rock, all with their battered roads leading to their entrances. Narrow spires of the same black rock emerged here and there from the peaks themselves. Between the pyramids were clusters of huge pillars and collapsed structures that could have been temples or palaces. Where the structures had fallen, they seemed to be merging back into the mountainsides. The most visible aspects of the ruins were the gigantic pyramids. In the regularity of their spacing, Gilliman thought they resembled battlement towers, with the mountains themselves serving as the ramparts. The orcs howled their challenge and rushed down the incline of the approach. "Bolter fire only," Gilliman ordered. "We will preserve the ruins." The tanks held back, and Gilliman charged forwards with the legionaries of the first chapter. Their stream of mass-reactive shells shredded the front lines of the orcs. When the two forces met, the Greenskins had already lost half their number. They still fought hard. For the first time in this campaign, it seemed to Gilliman the orcs were struggling to keep a possession. The ruins were theirs,
and there was outrage in their snarls as they tried to push the Ultramarines back down the mountains. Gilliman held the trigger down on the arbitrator. He sent death before him, and when he reached the bleeding horde, he struck with another weapon of death. Incandor flashed in his hand, severing limbs and throats with every gesture. He used his own body like a battering ram, slamming into brutes who cried out with pained surprise when it was they, and not their prey, who were sent flying backwards in the collision. He trampled over bones and skulls. He was a machine of efficient slaughter. He wasted no energy or gestures on any one foe. He butchered with grim conviction, but not with pleasure. The Xenos had no place on Thoas, and it offended him that they should try to claim a human relic as their own. But he was not Angron. Gilliman killed with brutal efficiency. He took satisfaction in victory and in the validation of strategy. When he and his sons trampled the orcs out of existence, they were extinguishing animalistic war with reasoned war. The brutish gave way to thought. This was the inevitable movement across the galaxy. His father brought enlightenment, and the old savageries had no choice but to fall away. The clash before the gate was brief. The Ultramarines outnumbered and outgunned the orcs. When the smell of physoline cleared, the enemy was a ruin of blood and shattered corpses, covering the ground before the doorway. Gilliman advanced to the doors.
"Marius," he voxed, "will you join me?"
Flanked by his Invictari honor guard, he studied the runes on the doors while he waited for the chapter master Primus.
"Can you read them?"
Gage asked when he arrived.
"No. The language is definitely human, but pre-Gothic.
How can you tell?"
Gilliman pointed to a rune a third of the way up the left-hand door. "The parallel lines on that one, and the linked curve. There is a family resemblance there to the runic inscriptions we found on Aletho II. These are older."
"You were correct, then. Human inhabitation of Thoas has a very long history."
"Yes."
"You sound uncertain."
And Gage sounded alarmed.
Gilliman smiled. "Not to be at this moment would be intellectually dishonest."
He gestured at the ruins visible along the curve of the mountainside. To the north and south, the columns of the other chapters were fighting their way up the slopes to their designated pyramids. "The damage to this civilization strikes me as being very old, too."
"Then the orcs have been here longer than we supposed."
"Perhaps. Let us see what waits for us inside."
The doors opened easily for their size. Gilliman had chains attached to each door, which were then pulled by rhinos. Metal ground against stone, and the way opened to the Legion. Gilliman walked in first with Gage at his side. Behind them marched the massed companies of the first chapter. The heavy armor came next. The entrance was wide enough for the tanks. While the Predators entered the pyramid, Gilliman ordered a line of Vindicators to remain at the entrance, facing outwards as the first line of defense against an attempt by the confused mass of orcs at the base of the mountains to reclaim the ruins. Beyond the doorway was a chamber so vast the air felt hollow. The roof of the pyramid had fallen in, revealing the gray of the Cordillera's perpetual dawn. Helmet torches and vehicle lights shone their beams over the walls. There had once been many levels inside the structure, but they were gone now. Scraps of metal marked where they had been, level with each of the exterior terraces of the pyramid. The flagstones of the ground floor were deep in green-skin refuse. Heaps of metal wreckage combined with organic filth. Gilliman could see twisted, jagged, and torn fragments that might have once been stairs or decking. On the walls were murals. They were so faded it was impossible to tell what, if anything, they once represented. On the lower levels, the orcs had defaced the interior with their own crude artwork, red and black grotesques in the shape of horned, snarling faces.
"So this is where the orcs scavenged their material," Gage said.
"So it would appear."
Gilliman looked up the height of the pyramid. If all the levels had had metal decking, the orcs would have found untold thousands of tons to use. Gilliman stared at one of the green-skin scrawlings.
"Do you notice anything about the walls?" he said.
Gage turned around, scanning the space.
"The orcs have only defaced the lower regions," he said.
"Exactly."
There was some orc handiwork visible as high as the first level or so, but it was scattered. By far the majority of the totemic faces howled on the ground floor. Why would that be?
They were too occupied tearing down the interior?
Perhaps. Gilliman didn't like the explanation. It was too simple. It made no allowance for the animalistic enthusiasms of the greenskins. They were not mindless. They were not servitors. He walked to the nearest wall. He examined the overlapping orc faces and the original art beneath. Some of the orc art was quite recent. Some, he could well believe, was over a century old. Their colours had faded, but nothing to the degree of the murals. All of the greenskin efforts were still clear. "What if the levels had already collapsed?" said Gilliman. "The wreckage would have been piled quite high initially." He pointed up. "The greenskins could have indulged in some of their art while salvaging the top of the heaps first."
"Those faces higher up do look more faded," Gage said.
Gilliman nodded. "Older," he said. "And the murals are older yet. Much older." He gazed at the hole in the pyramid's roof, hundreds of yards above him. If he had time to examine the edges of that gap, would he find evidence that the orcs had somehow caused that damage? He thought not.
"If the floors had already collapsed," Gage began.
"Yes. Theoretical. This civilization had already fallen when the orcs arrived." He ran his gauntlet over the wall. "There is a gap in time here," he said. "These murals have been fading for much longer than they have been defaced by the orcs."
"What do you think happened?" said Gage.
"Too early to speculate." He pressed his lips together. "Cultures do not need an external enemy to fail. They are born, they age, they lose their coherence, and they collapse. There is a remembrancer from the Age of Terror, a Willem Yeatus. My father showed me one of the fragments of his works that have survived. He wrote of the cycles of civilizations and of their inevitable end. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold," he said. "That is the tragedy of human history, until now, Marius. That is the cycle from which my father is saving us." Gilliman sighed, gazing at work that had become its own forgotten memory. He grieved for what had been lost. He had come to Thoas not expecting anything beyond the task of necessary extermination. He had held his hopes in check when the ruins had been discovered. He had told himself there would be nothing to salvage beyond restoring another piece of human history. He had taken for granted there would be no living humans to find. To hope for something different at the heart of a greenskin empire would have been madness. "You were hoping for something, though, weren't you?" he thought. "Yes. Yes, I was." He had hoped for signs of a heroic end. The civilization that had built these ruins had been capable of grand gestures. Their fall to the orcs would not have been without a vast struggle. But they did not fall to the orcs. He already knew what he would find as the Legion made its way deeper into the ruins. There would be evidence of decay, of a culture growing tired and losing its way. Fatigue, erosion, retreat from the heights once reached, and the collapse. There would be no glory there. He did not like to think of the orcs bringing energy to the world, yet that is what must have happened. The greenskins had arrived to find an empty shell, and they had turned it to their own violent but vital ends. He shook the melancholy away. The reclamation was still useful. Thoas would become part of Ultramar. It would live again, with the energy of light and reason, and its history would emerge from the night into which it had fallen. There was value in that.
"What do you think the purpose of this structure was?" Gage asked.
"You sound like you have some thoughts in that regard."
"Theoretical. A military command center."
"The metal decking," Gilliman said.
"Yes, very functional, but not suited to a hab zone."
"Your theoretical implies a similar function for the other pyramids."
"It does."
"By extension, this entire region of the mountain range is a single fortress. Particularly if the pyramids are connected." "A fortress entails defense," Gilliman mused. "Defense against what?"
"I can't speculate."
Neither could Gilliman. Gage's supposition made sense, but it raised many questions. We will find the answers, Gilliman said, once we have consolidated our position. He voxed Habron. Are the orcs moving our way yet?
Some, the tech marine said. Not in significant numbers. The current preparations will be enough to keep them out. There are battles to the south, but the larger portion of the horde is north of us.
Your evaluation of the enemy's state?
Still a viable force. Without knowing their precise numbers before we began, feel free to extrapolate.
Our strategy appears to have borne fruit. The initial push by the first chapter created a central focus for the horde, resulting in the formation of a core. The second wave destroyed that core. The orc force has been reduced.
You're not going to guess by how much, are you?
The attempt would be irresponsible.
Agreed.
Habron was right to be cautious. But the evidence of the success of the initial blow was clear. Gilliman turned back to Gage.
We move north. We will learn the extent of the ruins and reinforce the other chapters. We have the high ground now. The orcs must fight upwards from the plains, and their wave will break against our positions.
There were wide, arched passageways leading out of the pyramid at three levels, equally spaced on its great height, heading north and south. The upper passages were beyond reach, but the ones on the ground floor were immense, clearly designed to accommodate the mass movement of vehicles and crowds.
Troops, Gilliman thought.
Gage was right. The ruins had the marks of a gigantic military redoubt. And still the question, against whom? He led the way, and the first chapter began its march into the dark, bringing light, seeking illumination. From deep in the ruins, the howls of orcs echoed against stone. The 22nd chapter took the entrance to the northernmost pyramid 3 hours after the first one fell to the Ultramarines. Iasis's companies were the furthest north, and they were the last to enter the ruins. Iasis was conscious of that fact. He heard the reports over the command network of the Vox as he fought his way up the mountainside. He heard the other chapters storm the ruins, take possession, and begin consolidation. He was not troubled about being the last. What troubled him was Cirrus's reaction. He knew the captain disagreed with the order not to make a push towards the canyon. It was not until the companies of the 22nd had breached the pyramid that he realized the depths of Cirrus's discontent.
"We are losing the initiative, Chapter Master," the captain voxed.
"Explain your analysis," Iasis said, more out of necessity than interest. The final push to the lower doors had been bloody. The orcs had mounted a ferocious defense, bursting from the interior of the ruins in a huge wave. Their mass alone had been enough to push 2 land raiders and a rhino off the side of the approach. They had fallen, rolling end over end to a crushed, explosive end on the plain 1,000 yards below. Now Iasis stood in the center of the pyramid's enormous ground-floor chamber, his armor drenched in orc blood. His nostrils and lungs filled with the clammy foulness of the brutes with every breath. Around him the troops of the 221st Company established an impassable wall of ceramite at the entrance, while reconnaissance squads prepared to venture through the north entrance into the further ruins. The losses across the companies were high, and these legionaries hardly looked on him as a brother, even those who had been born on Macragge. Cirrus was edging close to insubordination, and Iasis no longer had the patience to tolerate his resentment.
"The rest of the horde is being sealed out of the ruins by the other chapters. The orcs have seen that we are last, our position as yet unsecured. They are shifting their efforts to our destruction."
"Then we are well positioned to destroy them when they arrive," Iasis said. He was standing beside his command rhino, Praxis. He ended the conversation with Cirrus and banged on the side. Tech Marine Loxias slid the door back.
"The greenskins coming up behind us have slowed. Theoretically, they are remaining out of range of our defensive guns until reinforcements arrive. How long will that be?"
Loxias turned and examined his screens.
"Longer than I would have predicted. The horde as a whole appears to be slowing at the foot of the mountains." "Are you sure?" "I have confirmed my readings and analysis with the Auspex systems of the other companies and chapters."
Iasis frowned. He distrusted anything that smacked of good news when it came to the orcs. The only truly positive development would be their extinction.
"Speculation," he asked.
He entered through the rhino's side hatch to get a better look at the Auspex.
"None that satisfies, Chapter Master,"
said Loxias.
The behavior is uncharacteristic.
Aesis tapped a Pict screen.
The horde looked smaller than it did earlier. It is occupying a smaller area,
Loxias confirmed.
Because of their losses, perhaps, and perhaps a greater concentration.
The Techmarine did not sound happy with his reasoning.
You don't think so?
Contraction of area and decrease in speed are both accounted for by the premise of greater density.
But?
The tactical benefit is limited. How many more orcs could attack us at one time?
You're assigning them the ability to strategize. These are orcs, brother. They could simply be confused, too. If they are coming after us, we present a multiplicity of targets and a multiplicity of points to defend, Aesis muttered.
The reports from the other pyramids painted rather different pictures from what the 22nd had encountered. All the other structures had suffered massive internal damage. All their upper floors had collapsed, and the metal decking had been scavenged by the orcs. This most northern of the pyramids was closer to being intact, inside and out. The approach to the southern face split up into four ramps, each rising more steeply than the last in order to reach the upper entrances. The interior floors were constructed of stone instead of metal. The floors were many feet thick, easily able to support the infantry and armor. Each level was empty, a huge, echoing chamber, void of equipment and purpose, except for the stink and debris of greenskin life. The walls were covered in vague, faded murals and orc obscenities. Ramps wide enough for two tanks to take abreast came down on the eastern side of the chamber.
You have reported what we found to the Primarch? Aesis asked. I have been speaking to my counterpart in the Flame of Illyrium, Loxias corrected. Lord Gilliman emphasizes the need to preserve this pyramid.
Aesis had come to the same conclusion himself. The ruins were the human history the Ultramarines would take back from the orcs. If there was anything to learn, this pyramid offered the greatest opportunity.
There is something else, Loxias said.
He changed a setting on the Pict screens. A schema of the pyramid appeared. It glowed a bright red.
Radiation levels in this structure are much higher than those recorded by the other chapters.
How bad is it?
Prolonged exposure would be fatal to mortals.
Which meant it should be within the tolerance of the gen-enhanced bodies of the Legiones Astartes, further shielded by their power armor. Even so, the anomaly was significant.
Can you identify the source? No, at present it is too widespread. Is this a bombing after effect? There is no visible damage.
Loxias changed the display to show the radiation reading across the mountain chain.
There is radiation everywhere in the ruins,
he said, showing Aesis the readings.
It is consistent with the effects of an ancient bombing over the other structures. The degree of radiation is correct, assuming a conflict at least 1,000 years ago, and likely much earlier.
But this pyramid is undamaged, Aesis said.
Yes, yet the radiation level is much higher.
Yes. What do you do with this information? Aesis wondered. You do nothing in this moment, he told himself.
Excuse me, Chapter Master,
Loxias said with a notable change in tone.
The Primarch will address the entire Legion.
Aesis straightened as Gilliman's voice reverberated out of his vox-bead.
Ultramarines, he said. We shaped the battlefield on the plain. Now we will do so again. We forced coherence on the foe and shattered its center. Now we will shape the war once more.
The voice was rich in strength and certainty. Gilliman spoke from knowledge, experience, and study. There was no hubris in what he said. His words were measured, his assertions chosen with care, and all the more inarguable. Aesis listened to the Primarch speak and heard the sound of inevitable victory.
Theoretical. The strong point controls the narrative of the war, forcing the foe to react within a narrowed range of possibilities. Practical. We will take and hold the ruins. Purge the ruins of the greenskins. They will attack, and the wave will break for the final time.
When Gilliman had finished speaking, Aesis addressed the 22nd.
Brothers, he said, we will have the honor of being the point on which the wave will break. Make our defenses strong. The orcs will believe they are laying siege to us. In reality, they will be making themselves vulnerable to our terminal advance.
He thought for a moment, then stepped out of the rhino and opened the private channel to Cirrus.
Is everything clear, Captain? He said, speaking coldly.
Perfectly, Chapter Master.
There was no more warmth in the reply.
As mazes go, at least it's spacious, Risen said.
The scout of the 223rd looked up and down the intersection, faced with a choice of empty darkness. Tarkas grunted in agreement. The sergeant pictured the tunnels crowded. The image was disturbing. It emphasized the wonder of the civilization's total disappearance. Millions must have worked here, and with great purpose. The military nature of the ruins was more than clear now. Beyond the pyramid, the tunnels became a network, and then a warren, each branch leading to more. Tarkas could foresee the tunnels leading off for hundreds of miles into the Cordillera. Smaller tunnels, some still wide enough for a single vehicle, ran off the main ones at irregular intervals. Beside the largest intersections, shafts that could swallow a Vindicator gaped. There were vertical grooves in the shafts, perhaps the remnants of a form of grav lift, Tarkas thought. The mountains were so hollowed out that their exteriors now seemed insubstantial. Many of the routes were blocked by rockfall, and Tarkas's squad had to double back or choose alternative routes so many times that it became impossible to plan a systematic reconnaissance of the ruins. There were more squads in the tunnels, and the 223rd was only in the network that led off the third level of the pyramid. Here and there, the collapses were extensive enough to open the tunnel to the sky. The cold wind of Thoas moaned through the tunnels like a spectre of loss. Some of the gaps were very wide and circular. Bomb damage, Tarkas thought, and not recent either. The edges of the craters were rounded from erosion. Scree had accumulated beyond the gaps, blown in by the wind. Everywhere, there were marks of the orcs having made the ruins their base. But the damage they had caused simply by existing in this space was visibly recent compared to the craters and cave-ins. The complex had died long before the orcs had arrived. Scout Fiorellus came back from having explored the next 100 yards of the eastward passage.
More of the same, he said, and still more branching.
Tarkas nodded. It was time to report to the captain once more. He contacted Cirrus on the Vox.
Our status is the same, he said. No sign of the enemy yet, and the region we are meant to control appears larger the more we see of it.
Can it be held? Cirrus asked.
Not in the sense of an occupation. This network is large enough to hold millions.
Your recommendation is to hold the pyramids.
It is. Let the enemy come to us. The orcs will, anyway. They don't skulk. We won't have to go looking for them.
Very well, Cirrus said after a moment. Make your way back to... A huge, echoing, discordant howling cut Cirrus off. It came from every direction, growing louder as it rode its own echoes. The greenskins were here, and they were close.
Contacts!
Tarkas yelled.
None, Risen said. They're out of Auspex range!
The amplification of the sound was making the orcs seem closer than they were, Tarkas realized.
To all scouts of the 22nd chapter, he voxed. Does anyone have readings on the enemy?
His answer was a confusion of voices, all asking the same question. Then Zarakus of the 221st shouted,
We have them! Coming up fast 200 yards north-northeast of the pyramid!
Scouts, Aesis broke in.
Withdraw! Return to strong points!
We're pulling back,
Tarkas told his squad. He led the way back down the tunnel at a run. He held his bolter ready.
Watch the Auspex,
he told Risen. He gave the scout the coordinates Zarakus had reported.
That's between us and the pyramid, Risen said.
Yes, it is.
They had worked their way over 1,000 yards northeast into the ruined network. Tarkas listened to Zarakus's voice as he ran. The scout updated the orc movements every few seconds. They were closing fast.
They must be coming up the shafts, Fiorellus said. Then why hasn't there been line-of-sight contact yet? Risen asked.
Zarakus's reports ceased. His voxcast dissolved into a blizzard of static, shouts and gunfire. Then it cut off. A moment later, Risen said,
I have them.
Where?
Tarkas demanded. How? He thought. The squad was still hundreds of yards from the reported position, unless the orcs weren't coming straight up. He blinked his visor lenses to prey sight, but there was still nothing.
Everywhere,
Risen said. The scout spoke with grim resolution. He knew and accepted what was about to happen. The echoes were deafening. The walls themselves were howling, as if the tunnels had become bestial moors. On the Vox, the reports from the other squads were a fragmented cascade. Orspec's contacts turned into running battles within moments. There was no way to gauge the size or direction of the horde. Ryzen was right, Tarkus realized. They are everywhere. The orcs attacked when the scouts reached the next junction. They poured out of the side tunnels. They surged from every minor break in the main passageway walls. As if a dam had burst, the green tide filled the tunnels. Everywhere. Tarkus and his scouts opened fire, shooting ahead and behind. They still headed for the pyramid, because those were their orders, and there was no action that made sense any longer except the fulfillment of duty to the end. They ran down a tunnel wide and high enough for a flight of thunderhawks. From one side to the other, it was filled with orcs. Tarkus ran towards the wave. A single squad charged thousands of greenskins. Behind, Tarkus heard the thunder of many iron-soled boots. He fired, and he saw orcs fall. He fired, and he was trying to kill an ocean. Solid shells from orc guns thudded against his armor. They chipped the ceramite. A lucky shot took out his right lens. A crossfire hail between the two hordes cut down dozens of orcs. It was so thick the impacts felt like power fists slamming into Tarkus's front and back. The scouts didn't have the armor to withstand so concentrated a barrage. They went down, their bodies punched through with dozens of impacts. Ryzen was last. He staggered on at Tarkus's side, his left arm broken, armor and carapace shattered, the holes in his torso too large for the scabbing agency of the Larriman's organ. He was bleeding out as he fought.
Purpose, Ryzen gasped.
Fulfilled,
Tarkus told him, hammering shells into the onrushing orcs. He dropped more.
We have served, he told himself. The orcs have come for us first. We have bought the chapter time to prepare.
He shouted warnings into the Vox. He gave his position. Ryzen was silent, staggering on, still shooting.
Beware the walls, Tarkus voxed. The orcs know of other shafts. They have the run.
A gigantic orc put on a burst of speed and stormed ahead of the rest of the horde. It was a monster, twice Tarkus's height, its face a snarling mass of scar tissue surrounding savage tusks. It swung a huge axe as it closed with Tarkus. Bullets hit him from behind. He staggered forwards, running into the edge of the blade. It smashed through his gorget and severed his throat. He could not speak. He could not breathe. Blood filled his lungs. He raised his bolter, holding down the trigger, stitching the orc through torso and head. The orcs at the rear stopped firing. They caught up. A cleaver came down through Ryzen's skull. Tarkus turned to avenge the scout. A beast with a metal fist punched him in the chest. His armor held, but the blow pushed him back. He stumbled into the weapons of the other orcs. The greenskins hacked at him with cleavers and axes as heavy as they were crude. The orcs hit him with blows that would have cut a mortal in half. He sank beneath them. He was still firing, and he heard the cries of wounded monsters. There were other shouts, too. They were tinny, small, and in his ear. They came from Siras, shouting the names of the 223rd Scout Sergeants. None were responding. Tarkus tried, but he was choking on his blood. His arms were tired, moving far too slowly, while the orcs attacked him with the speed and power of uncontained, explosive life. He was still struggling to speak as the darkness came down over his eyes. He hoped his captain had the time he needed to prepare. Silence fell before the dark. The orcs' jaws were wide, but no sound came from them. The blades cut through the gaps in his armor. The weapons rose and fell. He looked at them with detachment. It was as if they were no longer striking his body.
Is this enough? He wondered,
but could not ask. He sank to the ground, drowning in the green tide.